You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Genesis, Secrets of Creation. This is Lecture 10, given on the 26th of August, 1910. This lecture is not the last lecture in the book, but I believe it is the last lecture in the cycle, given that the next lecture, Lecture 11, is a lecture Steiner gave, I think, to prepare the way for the cycle, and it was on the portal of initiation. And that'll be the last lecture in this book, which was given earlier. Okay, a little bit confusing. This Lecture 10 was given on the 26th of August, 1910, entitled, The Way the Bible Accords with Clairvoyant Research. From all that has been said in the last few days, and especially yesterday, you will have been able to gather at about what point in time of our spiritual scientific description we have to place Genesis. In fact, we have pointed out that the first monumental words of the Bible mark the moment when we should say, in terms of spiritual science, that the substance, which is still that of a united earth-sun, is making ready to separate. Then follows the separation. And during this whole process, that which is described in the opening passages of Genesis takes place. The Genesis account covers all that happens right into the Lemurian age, up to the separation of the moon. And what is described by spiritual science as coming after the withdrawal of the moon, namely the age of Lemuria and the beginning of the Atlantean age, is to be found in the description following on after the days, in quotes, of creation. We mentioned this yesterday. We also referred to the profound meaning in the statement that man's body was imprinted with the dust of Earth-Moon. This was at the same point in time as the ascent in the cosmos, which we called the cosmic advancement of the Elohim to become Jehovah Elohim. We were to think of this advancement as more or less coinciding with the beginning of the moon's activity from outside. We must make sure we think of the activity of the moon, that is, of the beings who were connected with the process of the moon's withdrawal, and therefore of the moon's activity from outside, as being associated with the totality of the Elohim, with what we call Jehovah Elohim. So we can say, the effect of the moon on the earth in its first stage, corresponding with everything coming under the heading of the imprinting of the dust of the moon-like earth matter into the human body. Let me read that one more time. The effect of the moon on the earth in its first stage corresponds with everything coming under the heading of the imprinting of the dust of the moon-like earth matter into the human body. The human body, which up to this point had consisted solely of warmth, is given what is usually translated in the words, quote, and the Lord God breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul, close quote, or to put it better, a living being. We must not fail to notice the aptness, the grandeur, the power of the biblical words. I have impressed upon you that the moment of actually becoming earthly man depended on his being permitted to remain spiritually in a spiritual state until suitable conditions were present in the developing earth itself. Through the postponement of taking on flesh, he was able to become mature. If he had had to descend sooner from his spiritual state to a bodily one, let us say during the processes indicated by the fifth day, he could only have become a being physically resembling the creatures described as living in the regions of air and water. How does Genesis actually describe this essential nature of man? Wonderfully. The passage is a model of accurate and appropriate wording. We are told that the creatures, that is, the group souls who descended into earth matter on the fifth day, became living creatures, what we actually call living creatures today. Man did not descend as yet. The group souls who were still, as it were, in the great reservoir of the spirit world did not descend until later. And when the sixth day came, it was first of all the animals closest to man, the earthly animals proper, who came down. So even during the first part of the sixth day, man was not permitted to descend into solid matter, for if he had imprinted into himself at that time the forces of the developing earth, then physically he would have become a creature resembling the earthly animals. The group souls of the higher animals descended first and populated the earth as distinct from the air and the water. Only after that did the conditions gradually arise favorable to the formation of the prototype of humankind. How was it achieved? It is conveyed to us in momentous words, where we are told that the beings of the Elohim set about combining their activities in order to form man according to the image I described to you. So we have to say, Earthman arose first of all because the Elohim, each with a different capacity, worked together as a group to achieve a common purpose. Man began by being the common goal of the Elohim as a group. We must try to get a closer picture of what man was actually like on the sixth day. He was, of course, not yet like he is today. The physical body which man inhabits today only arose later, when Jehovah Elohim breathed into man the living breath. The event which is described as the creation of man by the Elohim took place before earthly dust had been imprinted into the human body. So, what was he like, this human being, whom the Elohim brought into existence as early as the so-called Lemurian age? Remember what I have often said about the essential nature of a present-day person. From a certain point of view, all human beings are the same, only with respect to their higher members. With regard to their sex, they are different, in that males have a feminine etheric body, and females a masculine etheric body. This is how our humanity is divided up nowadays. What appears as masculine externally is feminine inside, and what appears feminine externally is masculine inside. How did this come about? At a relatively late time, after the actual days of creation, a differentiation occurred in the human body. In the human being who arose on the sixth day of creation as the common goal of the Elohim, there was no such differentiation as the separation into man and woman. At that time, human beings still had the same kind of body. We can describe it best, as far as we can imagine it at all, by saying that the physical body was more etheric still, whereas the etheric body was somewhat denser than today. In other words, what is our dense physical body today was not as dense at the time it was formed by the Elohim, and the etheric body was denser than today. A densification toward becoming more physical only occurred later under the influence of Jehovah Elohim. So you will appreciate that we do not have any reason to speak of the Elohim's creation of man as male and female in today's sense, but that it was both male and female at the same time, not yet differentiated. The human being, therefore, who arose when the Bible tells us the Elohim said, "Let us make man," was not differentiated as yet, but was both male and female. And through this creation of the Elohim, man came into being male-female. This is the meaning, the original meaning of the words translated so grotesquely in modern Bibles, quote, "male and female created he them," close quote. This does not refer to male and female in today's sense, but to the undifferentiated human being, the male-female human being. I am well aware that numerous biblical commentators have objected to this interpretation, and with a kind of learned boasting have sought to ridicule the truth of what earlier, extremely wise commentators have already said on the subject. They try to discard the view that the Elohim's human being was at one and the same time male-female, and that this male-female human being was what was created in the image of the Elohim. I should like to ask such commentators what they base their argument on. It cannot be on clairvoyant investigation, for that will never say anything other than what I have just told you. If they rely on external research, I should like to ask them how, in face of tradition, they justify any other interpretation. One ought at least to tell people what the biblical tradition is. When through clairvoyant research we first discover the true facts, then these biblical texts are filled with life and light, and minor discrepancies in tradition no longer matter, because knowledge of the truth enables us to read the text correctly. But it is a different matter if we approach these things from the standpoint of philology. We should realize that right into Christian times, there was nothing even in the first chapters of the Bible to mislead anyone into reading the text as it is read today. There were no vowels in it at all, and the text still had to be broken down into separate words. The punctuations, which in Hebrew signify the vowels, were only inserted later. Without being prepared by spiritual science, what right has anyone to offer an interpretation of the original text, of which he can say, on the basis of scholarship and conscience, that it is reliable? So, where the Elohim's creation of man is concerned, we should see it as a preparatory stage of human existence. All the processes coming under the heading of, quote, human propagation, close quote, were at that time more etheric, more spiritual. They were on a higher level, one could almost say on a higher plane. It was the activity of Jehovah Elohim which first made man into what he has become today. That had to be preceded by the systematic creation of the other lower creatures. Thus, this latter creation became living creatures by what one might call a premature act of creation. The same expression, nephesh, living creature, is applied to these animals, and is, ultimately, applied to man. But how is it applied to man? At the moment when Jehovah Elohim comes on the scene and makes man into the man of today, we are told emphatically that Jehovah Elohim imprints man with neshama. It is through having a higher member imprinted into him that this man became a living being. That this same man became a living being. Note what an immensely significant and fertile concept is introduced into the theory of evolution by the Bible itself. It would be foolish in the extreme not to recognize that as regards his external form, man belongs at the peak of animal creation. This small concession may be made to Darwinism, but the essential thing is that man did not become a living creature in the same way as the other lower creatures, whose nature is described as nephesh, but that man had first to be given a higher member which had already been prepared in the soul's spiritual realm. Here we meet with another parallel between the ancient Hebrew doctrine and our spiritual science. When we speak of human soul qualities, we distinguish between sentient soul, intellectual soul, and consciousness soul. We know that initially these arose in their soul spiritual form during the first 3 days of creation. That was when they were first designed. But the incorporating of these, the imprinting of these in a physical body, which became the expression of the actual inner essence of man's soul being, happened much later. What we have to hang on to is that the spiritual part arose first. Then this is first of all clothed in an astral part, and then condenses stage by stage to the etheric physical level. And that, not until then, is the spiritual imprinted into it. What had been created earlier is imprinted into the body as the breath of life. Thus what was implanted as a seed into the human being by Jehovah Elohim had already been formed earlier. It was there in the womb of the Elohim. Now it is imprinted into man, whose bodily nature had been built up from another direction. So it was something that came through another stream. And with this imprinting of Neshama, it now became possible to give to man the potential to become an ego. For these old Hebrew expressions, Nefesh, Ruach, Neshama, are none other than what we have described as corresponding to our spiritual scientific terms of sentient soul, intellectual soul, and consciousness soul. We have to realize that the stages of this evolution form an extremely complicated process. We have to think of everything to do with the days of creation, everything that is the work of the Elohim before they advanced to Jehovah Elohim, as having taken place in higher spiritual realms. And what we can observe physically today in the human world did not arise until Jehovah Elohim began to be active. Everything we find in the Bible, and again now through clairvoyant perception, without which we should have no understanding of man's actual inner nature, all this was kept alive in the consciousness of Greek philosophers through their initiation centers. This was especially the case with Plato, but also even with Aristotle. Anyone familiar with the works of Plato and Aristotle knows that there was still an awareness that man first became a living being through the introduction of a higher soul-spiritual member, whereas the lower creatures went through different evolutionary processes. Aristotle expresses it somewhat as follows. He said that the lower animals became what they were through other processes of evolution, but that at the time when the forces which are active in the animals were able to become effective, the soul spiritual being of man, which still hovered in higher regions, was not yet permitted to acquire an earthly body, otherwise it would have remained at the animal stage. The being of man had to wait, and in him the lower animal stages had to be ousted from their sovereignty through the implanting of the human member. To express this, Aristotle made use of the word thyrestai. What is meant by this was, quote, "Of course, superficially speaking, man has the same bodily functions as animals, yet in the animal these functions are supreme, whereas in man the bodily functions have been dethroned and have to follow a higher principle." Close quote. This is what thyrestai means. The same truth lives behind the biblical story of creation. Through the implanting of Neshama, the lower members were dethroned. With the bearer of his ego, man has acquired a higher member. But his earlier, more etheric nature thereby became differentiated downward. Man acquired an external bodily member and an inner, more etheric member, the one becoming denser and the other more rarefied. The same principle was repeated in man, which we have come to recognize as running through the whole of evolution. We saw warmth being condensed to air and rarefied to light, air being condensed to water and rarefied to sound ether, and so on. The same process takes place on higher levels in man. The masculine-feminine element became differentiated into man and woman, and further, the denser physical body moved to the outside, and the more rarefied etheric body in an invisible condition to the inside. We could also call this a reference to the progress from the creation of the Elohim to the creation of Jehovah Elohim. The human being we know today is the creation of Jehovah Elohim. And the sixth day, therefore, corresponds to our Lemurian age, in which we speak of the male-female human being. The Bible also speaks of a seventh day, and we are told that on this seventh day, the Elohim ceased their work. What does this actually mean? How are we to understand this further episode? We only grasp it properly from a spiritual, scientific point of view when we realize that this is the very moment when the Elohim go through their advancement to Jehovah Elohim. But we must not think of Jehovah Elohim as being the whole hierarchy of the Elohim, but rather that the Elohim send only part of their being to the moon and hold the rest in reserve and continue their own further evolution in this established part of their being. This means that as far as this part of them is concerned, their work is no longer devoted to the nurturing of man, and they only work further on mankind with the part of their being which has become Jehovah Elohim. The other part does not work directly upon the earth, but devotes itself to its own evolution. This is what is meant by resting, in quotes, from working with earthly matters, by the Sabbath day, the seventh day. We must now call attention to something else of importance. If everything I have just been saying is correct, then we must regard the Jehovah human being, the human being into whom Jehovah impressed his own being, as the direct successor of the more etheric, more delicate human being who was created on the sixth day. So there is a direct line from the more etheric human being, the being who is still male-female, to the physical human being. This physical human being is the descendant, so to say, a densified form of the etheric human being. And if you wanted to describe the Jehovah human being who passes over to Atlantis, you would have to say that the human being who was created by the Elohim on the sixth day evolved into the unisexual human being, the Jehovah human being. Those who followed after the 7 days of creation are the descendants of the Elohim human beings, of what came into being altogether during the 6 days of creation. Again, the Bible is magnificent when, in the second chapter, it tells us that the Jehovah human being is in fact a descendant of the heavenly human being, the human being who was created by the Elohim on the sixth day. The Jehovah human being is the descendant of the Elohim human being in precisely the same way as the Son is the descendant of his Father. The Bible tells us this in the fourth verse of the second chapter, when it says that those who are to follow are the descendants, the subsequent generations of the heavenly human being. This is what it really says, but if you take a modern translation, you will find the strange sentence, quote, "These are the generations of the heavens and of the earth when they were created, in the day that the Lord God made the earth and the heavens," close quote. Usually the whole hierarchy of the Elohim is called God, and the Jehovah Elohim is called the Lord God. The Lord God made the earth and the heavens. I ask you, please, to look at this sentence carefully and try honestly to find a reasonable meaning in it. I would be glad to know if anyone can. Anyone who claims to do so had better not look on ahead in his Bible, for the word used here is toldot, which means subsequent generations, the same expression as is used when the subsequent generations of Noah are being discussed. It is speaking here of the Jehovah human beings as the descendants, the subsequent generations of heavenly beings, in exactly the same way as it speaks there of the descendants of Noah. So this passage should read something like this, quote, "In what follows, we are speaking of the descendants of the beings of heaven and earth who were created by the Elohim, and whose development was continued by Jehovah Elohim." Close quote. Therefore, the Bible, too, looks upon the Jehovah human beings as the descendants of the Elohim human beings. Anyone who wants to presuppose a fresh account of the creation, because it says that God created man, should also look at the fifth chapter, which usually begins, quote, "This is the book of the generations," close quote. The word used there is the same one as in the other passage, toldot, and I'll spell that T-O-L-D-O-T. Such a person might as well consider this, spelling of that is by me, the reader, sorry. Such a person might as well consider this a third account, thus making his rainbow Bible complete. Then you will have a Bible which is a compilation of separate fragments, but not a real Bible. If we could spend more time on this, we would be able to elucidate what is said in chapter 5 too. We see then, when we go deeply into these things, that there is full agreement between the biblical account of the creation and what we can establish through spiritual or esoteric science. This leads us to ask why the Bible account is in a more or less pictorial form. What do these descriptions represent? They make us realize that they too are the result of clairvoyant experience. Just as today the eye, E-Y-E, of the seer gazes into the supersensible realm, upon the origin of our earthly existence, so too did those who originally composed the Bible story gaze into the supersensible realm. It was by clairvoyant experience that the facts originally given to us were acquired. When we set to work to construct prehistory from the point of view of purely physical observation, we start from the traces of it which are extant and discoverable by external means. And the further back we go in physical life and physical origins, the more hazy the forms become. But in this misty element, spiritual beings are active, and the human being himself in his spiritual part was originally within them. If we pursue our study of the earth's creation as far back as the times Genesis is talking about, our earth merges with these primordial spiritual conditions. The days of creation refer to spiritual processes of development to be grasped only by spiritual investigation. What the Bible is telling us is that physical conditions form gradually out of spiritual conditions. This is how clairvoyant perception presents evolution. When the seer gazes upon the facts described to us in Genesis, he finds at first only spiritual processes. Everything described there is a spiritual process. A physical eye would see absolutely nothing. It would gaze into a void. But as we have seen, time moves on. Little by little, clairvoyant perception sees the solid element crystallize out of spirit, in the same way as ice forms and solidifies out of water. Out of the flowing sea of the astral, of the devaconic world, there emerges the shapes and forms which can now also be seen by the physical eye. That is, in the further course of clairvoyant observation, within the pictures which can initially only be grasped spiritually, physical existence emerges like a crystallization. Therefore it follows that at an earlier time, physical eyes would not have been able to discover the human being. Right up to the sixth and seventh days of creation, that is, right up to our Lemurian age, man could not have been seen by the physical eye, for he only existed spiritually. That is the great difference between a true theory of evolution and a trumped-up one. The latter assumes that physical development is all there is. But man did not arise through lower creatures progressing to acquire human form. It is incredible that people can think that an animal form turned into the higher form of a human being. Whilst these animal forms were arising, forming their physical bodies below, man had already existed for a long time. But it was only later that he descended and took his place beside the animals. Anyone who cannot look upon evolution in this way is beyond help. He is hypnotized, as it were, by modern concepts, not by scientific facts, but by contemporary opinion. If we want to describe man in relation to the rest of creation, we have to say that in the evolutionary process, the birds and marine creatures arose as two separate branches, and then as a special offshoot, the land animals. The former would correspond to the fifth day, and the latter to the sixth day of creation. Only then did man appear, though not by continuing the series, but by descending to earth. This is the true version of evolution, and it is contained more exactly in the Bible than in any modern textbook which succumbs to materialistic fantasy. These are just a few fragmentary remarks, such as always seem to be required in the last lecture of a series. To follow up adequately every aspect of such a theme as this would take months, for there is such a tremendous amount in Genesis. All that these lectures can do is plant seeds, get you going, and that is all I have attempted to do this time. I would like to give special emphasis to the fact that it was not especially easy for me to give this particular course of lectures, for it is no easy matter for someone who has been attending them to realize how difficult it is to reach the deeper foundations of the biblical story of creation, and to find the parallel between already ascertained spiritual facts and the corresponding passages in the Bible. If one works conscientiously, the task is an extremely exacting one. It is often assumed that the eye of the seer can reach whatever it wants to see, that you only have to look and everything comes by itself. An inexperienced person often thinks he can explain everything easily. But the further you probe, the more numerous the difficulties become. This is so even in ordinary external research. But when you go as far as stepping beyond physical research into the clairvoyant realm, then you are into real difficulties. And along with them comes the awareness of the great responsibility incurred if you want to open your mouth about these things at all. Nevertheless, I believe I may say that I have not made use of a single word in these lectures, which, as far as it goes in our language, is not an adequate expression which can lead to the right picture. But it was not easy. You know, the intention was there to ask our dear friend Herr Seiling to give a report at the beginning or end of these lectures about the 7 days of creation, and to do it in his artistic way of speaking, of which we had an example yesterday. You will easily understand how impossible it would have been to have the usual text spoken, especially as we had been searching for an adequate way to express what is actually being said in Genesis. And there was a very faint hope that perhaps at the end of today, something in the nature of an interpretation acquired through spiritual research might have been presented. But with a large invasion of visitors over the last few days, we could not possibly venture even to attempt to put together an interpretation of Genesis which would be fit to present. It would not have been the right thing to do, to try, and we must put it off until later. For the time being, we shall have to be satisfied with the brief indications you can glean from the lectures. For I assure you that I consider a real interpretation to be a task which requires about 100 times as much mental effort as I had to apply for our mystery play right from the moment of its first conception to the final step, the performing of it. Anyone who knows the difficulties will find the producing of a decent text of Genesis 100 times more exacting than what we were endeavoring to achieve with the mystery play, which in itself was no easy feat either. It is precisely when we tackle what are presented to us as the world's great mysteries that the difficulties pile up. And it is a good thing to be aware of this fact, because it is in recognizing and accepting these difficulties that we shall make progress in a right understanding of things anthroposophical. Our anthroposophical attitude must be one of broad-mindedness toward everything and everyone who should be cooperating so that anthroposophical activity can come about. Therefore, although we have our own definite working methods, we must on no account regard any other working method as not being suitable for us. Civilization today, in fact, the whole spiritual-cultural evolution of our times, necessitates different ways of arriving at one and the same goal. And even if it is not my province at all to come before you in any other way than as working out of esotericism, you will never find that I exclude another working method. I have particular reason to mention this at the end of these lectures, where we were led through the help of esotericism to such sublime heights of anthroposophical research. With this in mind, I would like to point out what a good thing it is if you can receive help from every direction in support of the anthroposophical point of view, and if you can also acquaint yourselves with what links up with our esotericism from other types of research. With this in mind, and so as to be all-embracing in this area, I would like to draw your attention to the positive good of a book written by our dear friend Herr Ludwig Deinhardt, which brings together so satisfactorily the kind of things which can be useful to us in investigations made in other ways. And as a good harmonious relationship has been sought for and demonstrated, particularly in respect of our kind of esotericism, this presentation cannot be anything else but beneficial even to us anthroposophists. You will find a number of things in it which can be useful to you on the anthroposophical path. I could mention many more things. I want to make sure to mention a second thing, something which has been borne in upon us at every stage in these lectures, namely, how essential it is that in our hearts and imaginations, anthroposophical knowledge should grow into something that is so inspiring to our inner life that we are raised to ever higher forms of perception and feeling, to ever more broad-minded and vital ways of understanding the world. It all depends on whether we become better people in regard to our intellect, perceptiveness, and morality. For that is the touchstone for the fruitfulness of what we can get in the spiritual scientific field. To study the parallel between spiritual scientific investigation and the Bible can be particularly fruitful, for it gives us the rare opportunity to experience that we have our primordial cause, our primordial state, as Jacob Boehme would have said, in that supersensible spiritual womb whence also came those very Elohim who rose to becoming Jehovah Elohim, to that higher evolutionary form, so that they could bring about the great goal of their creative activity, which we call man. Let us approach our origin with due reverence, but also with a due sense of responsibility. The Elohim and Jehovah Elohim gave of their greatest forces to set our evolution going. Let us regard our origin as laying upon us an obligation to our humanhood to take into ourselves more and more of the spiritual forces which in the course of subsequent evolution have entered into earth becoming. We have spoken of the influence of Lucifer. Because of this influence, a part of what lay in the womb of that spirituality, in which man too originated, remained behind in the lap of the gods, and appeared later in the incarnation of the Christ in the body of Jesus of Nazareth. Since that time, Christ has been active in earth development as a second divine principle. Contemplation of the great truths of Genesis ought to point us to the duty of taking up increasingly into our own being the spiritual being of the Christ. For only by filling ourselves with the Christ principle shall we fulfill our whole task as human beings, and become on earth more and more like what we were predisposed to be in those times indicated in the biblical story of creation told in Genesis. Therefore, a lecture series such as this can not only give us knowledge, but can stir forces to life in our souls. Even if we forget some of the details, may what we have learned from looking more closely at Genesis work further as soul force. I may perhaps be permitted to say at the close of these few days, during which we have been trying again to immerse ourselves deeply for a short while in the stream of anthroposophical life, let us try to take from these thoughts we have acquired the forces which they ought to engender. Let us carry them forth, and let us fructify by means of these forces our life in the outside world. Whatever we may be doing in life, whatever secular vocation we may have, these forces can be a beacon light for our actions, and can both fructify our activities and enhance our joy and happiness. And no one who has understood the sublime origin of human existence in the right way can go on living without absorbing this knowledge as a constant source of living joy. If you want to do loving deeds, let the truth about the stupendous origin and destiny of humankind shine out from your eyes. That is the best way to spread anthroposophy. Our deeds will prove its truth, bringing joy to those around us, and having an uplifting, cheering, refreshing, and health-giving effect on us in spirit, soul, and body. We should be better, healthier, and stronger people through taking in anthroposophical thoughts. The most important thing is that a series of lectures such as this should work in this way. It should be a germinal force, which on entering the soul of the hearer springs forth and bears fruit for those around us. Although physically we go our separate ways, anthroposophists remain united in spirit. Let us collaborate in that we translate this teaching into life. Let us be filled with this spirit without weakening until the moment arrives when we come together not only in spirit, but meet again in the flesh. The end of Lecture 10.